Thank you. It makes it easier. Now, number one, obviously, this is totally informal, anybody can ask me anything. But we're going to talk about, what I was assigned was two topics. One, hereditary angioedema, which is a topic where the disease is extremely well known and the treatment has been absolutely led to virtual cure for most people. Now, there aren't a whole lot of people at the Immunodeficiency Foundation who are interested in hereditary angioedema, and the reason is that there's a Hereditary Angioedema Association, which has really done a terrific job of gathering together information on all the patients, getting the patients together, and in fact, they're going to have they had a meeting in Orlando a year and a half ago. They're going to have a meeting in Denver this fall. Most of the hereditary angioedema crowd are sort of linked into that group, and they really are a very knowledgeable group. The hereditary angioedema business is particularly interesting to the pharmaceutical companies because, in fact, many different drugs have been worked out. They all are remarkably effective. And so this is a very different situation than the situation that some of you have heard about with chronic granulomatous disease, for example, or with Scott-Olbert syndrome, where people are laboriously figuring out what the defects are, and a lot of advances have been made there. But then the next question you get to is, how do you correct the defects? And in fact, in hereditary angioedema, we know the answer. We've made the drugs that correct the defects, and the only question that people are left with is, how do you put in the right gene? But people can lead a perfectly normal, perfectly healthy life. That is not true for chronic granulomatous disease. It's not true for Wiskott-Olbert syndrome. And so the hereditary angioedema folks are sort of gathered together to celebrate their good luck, but also to figure out the little things that are going wrong that they think they can deal with. So the first talk we're going to deal with is hereditary angioedema, and it's very straightforward from my point of view as a physician who takes care of those patients. I also was asked to talk about complement deficiencies. This is an area which also is not well represented in the Immunodeficiency Foundation because it's not well understood. We have made enormous advances in understanding in the last few years. But because it's not well understood, in fact, there are almost no people working on it. There are no drug companies working on it. There are no physician scientists working on it. It's an area where the Europeans are doing more than the Americans. And changes will be made that are very big changes over the next few years. The reason that I say that changes will be made is, were you to ask the people who run this Immunodeficiency Foundation, they would say, there aren't very many complement deficiencies. It turns out that many of the diseases that we take for granted as not being understood turn out to be complement-related diseases, and the way it's found out, for the most part, has been genetic studies rather than complement studies. So that's a totally different subject. 15 years ago, these two subjects would have been considered part and parcel of the same problem. Now we know it's not true. We know it's completely different systems. So let's go through the one that's straightforward. Hereditary angioedema, it's a pleasure to talk about it. And the reason it's a pleasure to talk about it is there aren't too many diseases in this institution or in this that they're talking about this week that are completely understood and completely cured for most people. And this is one. So let's start with what is hereditary angioedema. So hereditary angioedema has actually been known since the 1800s. And it's been known that there are some people who get this kind of swelling of a hand. The swelling in the lower, let's see if I have a pointer. The swelling here of the lower hand is really pretty impressive. And in fact, it can lead to such severe swelling that I've seen patients operated on to let the fluid out of their hand because, in fact, the feeling was that they would lose their hand. So hand swells up for a day and a half. Yeah, sure. Anybody can break in any time. It's almost always unilateral.
It is.
Yeah. In fact, when it's not, if it's symmetrical, both hands swell up, both feet swell up, it's probably not hereditary angioedema. This swelling is almost, now it can go from one hand to another. You can have both hands swell up, but if you ask these people, do you ever get a hand swollen or a foot swollen, the answer is yes. Now these people have this swelling that comes out of the clear blue sky for the most part. There are things that we'll talk about that can bring on the swelling in some people, but many times it just comes out of the clear blue sky. This, as we know now, is a hereditary disease, and I'll get into it. But this, as you can see, if you have the hand that looks like the one in the lower right side of my screen, you have a problem. If you're going to go to work, if you have to use a computer, if you have to cook, if you have to do anything, you can't. This swelling usually gets worse for a day and a half and then very slowly resolves. Sometimes it moves from hand to foot. Sometimes it moves from one hand to another. So this is one of the problems that people get. The next thing that they get, and the reason that they actually wind up with most physicians, is shown in this slide of one of my patients. And it's not a slide that's clear to people who aren't physicians, but what you can see, let's see if I can point it out to a certain extent. The GI tract should not look like this. These are folds of bowel that are swollen. And in fact, they're swollen just like the folds, just like the hand is swollen. And again, it tends to get worse for a day and a half and then better for a day and a half. Now, this turns out to lead to excruciating pain. So these patients are in such pain that they can't stand it. And often they'll go to an emergency room and they'll see a surgeon. And this is a rare disease. The surgeon may never have seen a case of this. But he knows that if he sees somebody with this kind of abdominal pain, it usually means they've got something going on in their abdomen. So these people go to the OR. And basically they get their appendix taken out. They get their gallbladder taken out. They get something taken out. But in fact, it's not the reason for the pain, and the pain doesn't go away with the operation. And the next time it comes along, it'll come along again. Now, some of these patients have one or two or three attacks a year. But some of them have one or two attacks a month or even three or four, the rare patient. And these patients' lives are completely ruined. I've had patients who knew what their disease was, who knew how to treat it, who had the medications available to treat it, who had abdominal pain, and it was so severe they couldn't even get to an emergency room. They had to have an ambulance come, pick them up, put them on a stretcher, and take them in. Now, with the medicines we have available, and we'll get to it, the new medicines will cure a patient like this in an hour. But in fact, you got to have the right diagnosis, and you got to know what you're treating. One of the patients who had a hand, like the one I showed you before, came into our emergency room. So this is a place where we see these patients regularly, where we know the disease, and the physicians in the emergency room did not know what they were dealing with. But they did know that the patient might lose, in this case, her hand. And so they sent her to the OR to let out the fluid. And they made incisions in her hand to let out the fluid. If they had made the right diagnosis, she would have been cured in an hour. But they didn't make the right diagnosis. And so this is an easy diagnosis to make. But you got to know what you're looking for. And since it's a rare disease, you often don't make the right diagnosis. Now, some of these patients have something that looks like circles on the skin. At the start of an attack, it's called erythema marginatum. It's interesting because it goes with rheumatic disease and we have no idea what it's about. This is one of my patients. This is on the left is a picture of her taken by a photographer when she was well. And on the right is a picture taken by her husband in those days with a Polaroid camera when she was not so well. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to understand that if that swelling were to extend into her airway, she might choke to death. And when we describe the first group of patients with this disease, we ask them, how many members of your family, since this is a hereditary disease, with this illness choked to death? And the answer was a third. So this is a big deal. Now, the truth is that most patients don't have this happen. They don't choke to death because it only happens once or twice or three times in a lifetime. But in fact, it's a bad thing when it happens. Now, when we started working on this, there were no treatments. And so this was a really big deal. As I said, there are treatments now. This is a cured disease, and we'll get to it. It's a disease that's understood. It's a disease that where the pathophysiology is completely worked out. And knowing that, it's been possible to develop drugs that basically make the patient's life totally and completely, or pretty close to totally and completely normal. And as you can see, it affects every ethnic group. This is another one of my patients, and you can see again that this is a pretty big problem if you've got it. Now, a differential that I want to make is the differential between angioedema and what is called hives or urticaria. The top picture is hives or urticaria, and it's intensely itchy. The swelling of hereditary angioedema in general is not itchy. Now, I've seen patients with itchy swelling with this disease, because if you have one disease, it doesn't prevent you from getting another one. But the truth of the matter is that most of the patients don't itch. So, this is, on the left is a slide which shows what percentage of the various kinds of episodes the patients get. And you can see that in this group of large group of patients, the number of skin episodes, that is hands, feet, genital area can swell up, is about equal to the number of stomach attacks, but the stomach attacks just slightly less. Everything else is much less, including the swelling that affects the airways. And this slide on the right simply makes that point again, and we really don't have to spend a lot of time talking about it. Now, this is a rare disease. This is a slide that was put together by a man named Marco Ciccardi, who's in Milan. And Marco Ciccardi is another expert in this disease, and he set up a clinic in Milan where he wanted patients from all over Italy with hereditary angioedema to come in. And after a period of time, one of his fellows published this paper. And first of all, you can see that of all of the patients that they saw, and the number is in the upper corner of the slide, he had almost 800 patients. Only 25% had C1 inhibitor deficiency, and we'll talk about C1 inhibitor deficiency as a manifestation of hereditary angioedema. So 800 patients were sent to him, and only a quarter had the disease that he was looking for. And he's Italy's expert. People will come from all over Italy to see him. The area underneath, the one that says 38, that's unknown. They never did figure out what in the world these patients had angioedema for. So, in fact, angioedema is a swelling. It doesn't have to be itchy. In fact, it shouldn't be itchy. It can affect your hands and feet. It's really, it's not uncommon, but in any one particularly allergic person, they'll get angioedema. You can get angioedema with a lot of different situations, but the majority of these situations, it's not hereditary angioedema, and in fact, it's called idiopathic, which really means unknown. Now, the idiopathic group is divided into something called histaminergic and non-histaminergic. Histaminergic means you give the patients high-dose antihistamines and it goes away. And that's the average kind of angioedema that people get. And non-histaminergic means there's still a group of patients out there, and in fact, it's a pretty large group, in which we don't know what causes their swelling, and in fact, they don't get better with antihistamines, and so we still have some work to do. As I say, it's the hereditary form that we really understand. Now, the fact that this is a hereditary disease has actually been known for a long time, and this is one of my families and gives you some clues. The black squares and circles are patients, and so what you see is, first of all, if you look down generations, every generation has the disease, so it doesn't tend to skip generations. This is what is called an autosomal dominant mode of inheritance. What does that mean? It means that you have two chromosomes, for every one of your chromosomes is double. when a male mates with a female, half the chromosomes come from the male, half the chromosomes come from the female. They reassort in the child. So you have double of everything. If even one of the genes for this that can control this disease goes wrong, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail, it means that in fact you can get this disease. So that means that the patients, for the most part, have one from one of their parents, normal gene, and one abnormal gene from the other parent, or it's a new mutation. That's not the common kind of inheritance. In the common kind of inheritance, if you've got one normal gene from either parent, you can get along without the disease. That's not true for this particular disease, and the reason is that the protein is used up, and we'll talk about that. Sometimes you're lucky, and you find out what the protein is, and sometimes you're not lucky, and we'll talk about that with regard to this disease, because it turned out that we and the patients were very lucky. Now, as you can see on this slide from my original patients, and now, in fact, there are hundreds of patients that have been studied, but the slide turned out to be accurate. This is a disease that starts in childhood, but it's almost always very mild in childhood. And with all of the knocks and bruises that kids get and all the stomach problems that they have, patients and doctors tend to discount it. They say, well, you know, he's got a stomach ache. Lots of kids get stomach aches. Or he's got swelling. He probably fell. And it gets better by itself, so people don't worry about it. And then what happens at puberty is it becomes much more severe. We still don't fully understand that. We know that in women, estrogens make it much more severe. But why males get more severe at the time of puberty, also not understood. As I said, we've got treatment, but we don't have total understanding. Now, there are things that bring on attacks. As I said, most patients have no idea if they're going to have an attack a week from Thursday. And that's terrible, because suppose you want to go to a family reunion, or you want to go to work, or you have a business meeting, and you don't know whether you're going to be well or sick. That's a big problem. But things bring on attacks. One of them is trauma, as I showed in this little representation. So the kind of trauma that brings on an attack in some people, but not all, is the kind of trauma that you get when a woman is using a pair of scissors to cut cloth so that constant pressure on her hand will make the hand swell up. Or somebody is using a power lawnmower and that causes a hand to swell up. It's interesting because I don't tell kids who have this disease not to play touch football or football. So it's not that kind of trauma. Nobody understands that one either. Occasionally, infections will bring on an attack. In women, menstruation very commonly brings on attacks. And again, not understood. We'll talk about medications, because there are some medications that turn out to be completely contraindicated and, in fact, are related to this disease. And in fact, we're in the middle of a study of a series of medications called ACE inhibitors. They're used for hypertension, and they make this disease much worse. Knowing that, we've asked the question, can the medications that have been set up that work for this disease work for ACE inhibitor angioedema? And the answer is yes. Hi.
Hi.
Okay. And the last thing on this slide is stress. And that's something that's really interesting. When patients are under stress, when something happens that really makes their lives miserable, their attack frequency goes way up. And when we did some of the original trials with treatment, we had one patient who on treatment got much worse. Most of the patients got much better, but this lady got much worse. And the question was why? And the answer was her marriage fell apart, her job fell apart. She was under enormous stress. And so she got worse, and it's commonly true. It's true for most patients. Now, okay, I'm going to keep this to the clinical side of things for the most part and not get into science too deeply. But in fact, the reason that we know about this disease is good luck. Basically, there is a protein in the blood which I have represented with this line, called C1 inhibitor. And it turns out that this protein is abnormal in this disease. How did we find that out? As I said, it was good luck. There was a guy at Western Reserve whose name was Li Pao, and he was interested in the complement system. I'm going to talk about complement in the last hour if people are interested, because I think that, in fact, it's the key to a lot of problems. And we're just beginning to understand how it's the key. But everybody's discounted the system. There's almost nobody in America working on it. But be that as it may, there was this man, Li Pao. And he was interested in the complement system, and he was interested in something that inhibits one of the proteins of the complement system, and he named it C1 inhibitor. And he studied it. Now, down the hall, there was an allergist, Virginia Davison, and she was a buddy of his. And he made antibody to this protein, and she said, well, why don't I take your antibody and screen all my patients with all my diseases and see if anything comes up? And so she did, and she discovered that this protein was abnormal in hereditary angioedema. She was elected to one of the most prestigious academic organizations in America, the National Academy of Sciences, on the basis of this discovery. But it was pure chance. It could have been another disease, it could have been whatever. Or if Li Pao hadn't made an antibody to this protein, never would have been found. Now, we know how this protein works. It comes as a single chain protein, as I show you here on the left, and buried in that single chain is a highly reactive group. Now, everybody recognizes a Pac-Man. If an enzyme comes along, it sees what is called a bait sequence on this protein right here, and it looks like what it eats. So, in fact, it cuts the protein right here. It exposes this group. The group kills the Pac-Man by binding to its mouth, and the combination is removed from the circulation. So that's the way the protein works, and it's used up. You can see you can only use it once. And that's why half the protein, since everybody has one normal gene and one abnormal gene, that's why half the protein is not enough to keep you from getting sick. Now, in fact, this is a molecular representation of the protein, and it's not really very hard to see where the bait sequence is. So, in fact, it's actually fairly amazing. It works like a mousetrap. There's a piece of cheese. The mouse comes along and grabs the cheese, and it goes thwack and kills the mouse. Now, the complement system is very complicated. We're going to get to it if anybody's interested in the second hour. In fact, I'm going to talk about it whether you're interested or not. But be that as it may, it has nothing to do with this disease except in one respect. And that is that the C1 inhibitor, which this man had worked on and figured out, has the job of turning off a protein called C1. And that protein's job is to cleave the next two proteins, C4 and C2. For decades, people thought that this had something to do with the development of the disease. It turns out it doesn't. But what it does do is make it really easy to diagnose, because every single hospital can do a C4 level because it's used to follow lupus. And so patients can get a C4 level. It's a cheap test. It can be done in an hour if they want to, but it can be certainly done overnight. And that way, it's an easy way to make the diagnosis. Turns out it has nothing to do with the disease. And that brings me to another point, and that is that the C1 inhibitor has a lot of different functions, which we didn't know when we started this. At the top of this graph is the fact that, if I can find the pointer, is that it affects many things in the complement system. Has nothing to do with this disease. Then it has a whole bunch of systems that have something to do with what is called contact activation. And that is that when you get a cut, there's a free surface, you have to close that cut. And there are a whole bunch of systems that have to do with this so-called contact activation. So one example is the clotting system. You got to be able to clot that cut so that it doesn't continue to bleed. There's something called the fibrinolytic system. That means that if it clots and it's stopped bleeding, you have to have a mechanism in your blood for dissolving the clot. And people who have heart attacks often have a clot in their coronary arteries, and they don't get dissolved fast enough. So fibrinolysis is part of it. And there's a third system, which we really still don't quite understand, which turns out to be very important in this disease, called the kinin-generating system.
And there's a peptide generated called bradykinin, which causes your vessels to leak. Now, what in the world it's doing in you now, or me now, is not at all clear. What the C1 inhibitor does is basically determine the set point for teeter-totter, for the seesaw. In other words, if the C1 inhibitor is down here, it means that it tends to be on this side. If the C1 inhibitor is down here, it rolls this way. So, in fact, it tells you whether you're going to be clotting more, whether you're going to be lysing clots more, whether you're going to be generating kinins more, etc. And that's something that we really still have to work out. Now, this is a complicated slide, and it's the only complicated slide you're really going to see. But basically, what it says is how the system works. And it's not, when you see the complement system, you realize it's not a complicated system. It looks complicated on this slide. There is a protein in your blood called prekallikrein, and basically everybody has it. There's a second protein, as you see by the blue line, it's linked, circulates with the prekallikrein, called high molecular weight kininogen. If the prekallikrein gets activated, it generates an enzyme called kallikrein. That enzyme feeds back on the protein that's bound to it, high molecular weight kininogen, and bradykinin is formed. So there are two basic things that you have to remember, at least about hereditary angioedema. Kallikrein is an enzyme that's formed. Bradykinin is the ultimate product. The kallikrein is controlled by the green squares, which is C1 inhibitor. And there's another thing that controls kallikrein formation, and that is these factors which relate to the clotting system. So I said that there's the clotting system, the fibrinolysis system, they're all intimately involved, and sorting all that out is actually what a lot of people are doing at the present time. Ultimately, if the system doesn't get turned off, you get bradykinin. Bradykinin binds to a receptor on your cells in your blood vessels and leads to angioedema. So although this looks very complicated, it really is only two or three proteins, and bradykinin is formed. Now, it took a long time to figure this all out. And the reason it took a long time to figure it all out, when it only took an afternoon for Virginia Donaldson to figure out that C1 inhibitor is important in hereditary angioedema, is that nobody really understands what bradykinin does exactly, particularly in an adult, and there are no hospital tests for bradykinin. In fact, there are no hospital tests for any of the proteins in this system except the clotting factors. And so, and they only last in the circulation a few seconds. So, in fact, it took a long time to figure this out, but the fact that C1 inhibitor was somehow involved took very little time to figure out. So, treatment of hereditary angioedema. Long-term treatment, short-term treatment, and acute treatment. We usually divide it into three phases. And we've got all of them under control at the present time. 30 years ago, I figured out that a protein, that a drug that was just coming on the market called danazol would actually work in these patients and prevent them from having attacks. And we published that as long ago as 30 years ago. In fact, it worked prophylactically. If you took a pill every day, you didn't have any attacks, but it didn't work for attacks, so it didn't work for acute treatment. And this drug turned out to be really very important. Now, it has pluses and minuses, like every drug. There is no such thing as a totally safe drug. And this drug was developed as a female contraceptive. It turns off your periods, so that's one of the things that it does. But also, it's a derivative of an androgen. And androgens have lots of side effects. Now, it turns out that at the doses that most people were on, the androgenic effects were not terrible, but in some people they were. And so, in fact, we had the first drug that was useful in prophylaxis, and it's still used today. I made the decision in the early days that we wouldn't give it to children because I was afraid that it would affect their growth. In fact, some of my European colleagues, particularly my Hungarian colleagues now, I was in Hungary just a few weeks ago, are actually using it in children. It has some tremendous advantages and some tremendous disadvantages. Let's talk about the disadvantages first. The disadvantages are it's an androgen, and that means that it has the potential of causing androgenic effects, and we'll talk about that. The advantages are also terrific. A, it's low dose in most people. B, it's cheap. And what you will see is that the new drugs are breathtakingly expensive. The reason that the Europeans are so interested is that they don't have the same kind of health insurance situation that we do. And so, in fact, getting the new drugs sometimes is a real problem for some of their population. So this is the original treatment results of the first study we did, and it just makes a point. And that is, we took a bunch of people on with hereditary angioedema. You'll see there were 88 courses of drug, which were a month long. You can see that half of them were placebo, half of them were danazol. You can see that the patients on danazol had one attack, and the patients on placebo had 43 attacks during that period of time. So, in fact, the drug was very, very effective. And it still is very, very effective. And it's interesting. We'll get to it, but my German colleagues didn't want to use it. They had different drugs, which we're going to talk about in a minute, which we now have, but we didn't have for 20 years. And so they didn't use danazol. And they've come around. They're actually using some of it now. This is a patient who was on... this was the level of C1 inhibitor. When she started danazol, and a magical thing happened. Her C1 inhibitor went to normal. We stopped the drug, came back down to the original, started it again, went back up. So this is a drug that can correct the C1 inhibitor in a tiny minority of patients, but this is a very high dose. And so, in fact, we don't use that high dose. We don't try to correct the C1 inhibitor. All we're trying to do is keep patients relatively free of attacks, and it turns out very low doses often will do that. Now, this is side effects of an androgen, and you can see it's a very, very, very long list. The biggest thing in women is weight gain. They hate it. And I know that there are some people in this room who have taken danazol who have had weight gain. Yes?
Is it strictly for females then?
No. It can be used in males and females. Males have much less trouble, and the reason is obviously they're used to having androgens circulating, so they don't feel differently. They basically tolerate the drug. Most of the patients that we see, 60% of the patients that we see are female. And the reason is that estrogens make it so much worse. Menstruation makes it a lot worse. So, in fact, the ones that are in trouble are the women that are taking this drug. The males don't notice anything, for the most part. And you can see it can lead to lipid abnormalities, liver function test abnormalities. This is a long list. And some women simply can't take it. Now, the other thing that's happened in recent years is Lance Armstrong came along, and Barry Bonds came along, and people started to say taking androgens is the worst thing in the world you can do. So I can tell you that there's no woman who comes into my clinic or anybody else's clinic, and you say to them, we can give you an androgen and it's relatively low cost, or we can give you one of the new drugs that has no androgenic properties that's very high cost. What would you rather do? Because we always let the patients decide. And the answer 100% is we don't want to be on androgens. This is useful. It's useful in some parts of the world. It's useful in the patients who started before the new drugs came along. And the first of the new drugs came along in 2008, so it was pretty late. And so people who have been on it for a very long period of time and who don't have any side effects say, well, take one pill in the morning, come on. And they continue on it. I've had one patient, one of my early patients from that original trial that you saw, who had been on it was a male, been on danazol for 40 years, had no side effects. He went to his allergist and he called me up. This is now 3 or 4 months ago. And he said, I've gone to a new allergist, and the reason is my old allergist retired. I've been seeing the man for 40 years. And my new allergist says it's an exceedingly dangerous drug and that I should be switched to a new agent. Well, he said, I've been on the drug for 40 years. Do you think that's a good idea? And I said, stay with it. So, new therapies were needed. The androgens don't work for 48 hours, and they didn't work for acute attacks. They had to be given orally. And basically, oral is not good if you're having a stomach attack. We never used them in children, and we certainly never used them in pregnancy, where they could cause they could cause mutations. The androgens are ineffective in some people. And the other drugs that were developed, and there is a drug that was developed in Europe called tranexamic acid, also didn't work for 48 hours. Many of the drugs were inconvenient to take. There were toxic side effects. And we won't get into fresh frozen plasma at all unless anybody wants to talk about it. So now we have lots of new therapies. They're all breathtakingly expensive, and they all work. And they all work about equally well. If you have this disease and you start to have an attack, you can be assured that you're going to get better or start to get better in an hour and a half, and in 2 or 3 hours, it's going to be over. And in fact, some of them can be used for prophylaxis. The one that was approved for prophylaxis is this drug called Cinryze. And there's another drug, which is essentially the same drug, which is made by CSL Behring, which, of course, is one of the sponsors of this meeting, which is used for acute attacks. We're going to talk about all of these drugs very briefly, because, if anything, we're running late. So I showed you this picture before, and I said Kallikrein works on high molecular weight kininogen to release bradykinin. So things that turn off Kallikrein will be effective. Now, I told you about Virginia Donaldson. At the same time shortly after Virginia Donaldson showed this abnormality, the Dutch Red Cross got busy trying to make purified C1 inhibitor. A company in Germany called Behring Pharmaceuticals, which is now CSL Behring, started to make C1 inhibitor because they were purifying proteins from plasma. And the American Red Cross decided to make some of the protein. And the American Red Cross was the protein that we used. And again, I'll show you we first showed that it worked in 1980. But in 2096, with my good colleague at Harvard, Fred Rosen, and one of my fellows, Tom Waitis, we published this paper in the New England Journal giving the protein intravenously. And we did it both in an acute attack and for prophylaxis. The protein goes right up if you give it intravenously. Obviously, you just put it in the vein. And then it comes down very rapidly. So, in fact, it's a short-lived protein. And that's bad. It means that 3 days later, we had to give another shot. And 3 days later, we did give another shot. And you can see you got this sawtooth pattern. I said that C4 is a good way of testing for the effect of the protein. And in fact, it has nothing to do with the disease, but it does have to do with the effectiveness of the protein. And you see it comes back into the normal range and stays in the normal range. And these are placebo patients. The placebo didn't do anything. And I won't go into this. It worked in acute attacks as well. So in 1996, we published the fact that we had a protein made from blood that would end attacks and could be used for prophylaxis. Now, you'd think with that kind of information, the disease would be under control, especially since the Europeans did not do any studies, but their impression was the same. And that is the Germans with their protein thought it was the same, the Dutch with their protein thought it was the same, and nobody thought they could make any money. And guess what? The Europeans refused to send their protein to America when we asked for it. Because they didn't want to go under FDA control. And what happened with the American Red Cross protein was we published our paper saying that it worked in 1980. In 1980, the American Red Cross was faced with a different problem. The problem was AIDS and HIV virus in their donors. And they said, a few people with hereditary angioedema, we're going to forget about them. There are a lot of people who can get HIV. Remember, they had hemophiliacs who were getting HIV from infusion of the protein, and so they lost interest completely and never gained interest again. So this is the German product. It's called Berinert. It was first licensed in Germany in 1979, and it was never studied in a double-blind study until now, but it was reported on extensively, and everybody agreed that it worked. And this is the kind of data that they got in Germany. They didn't do any double-blind studies, that is, looking at controls, but this is treatment, time to relief of abdominal attacks. And you can see what I said is about right. By 30 minutes, many of these patients were starting to have a lot of relief. And if you look at the numbers on the left side of that slide, 1,800. Now, this was only 30 or 40 patients. So they had patients having attacks all the time. They weren't getting any kind of prophylactic treatment. They were in pain a lot of the time because they had 1,800 attacks during the time that they were followed. At least they had more than 1,800 if you add up all the numbers. But they started to get better in 30 minutes, and by 2 hours or so, most of them were well. So they isolated it from plasma. The Dutch did the same thing. They isolated it from plasma. And in fact, as early as 1978, they reported one paper in Germany saying that, in fact, they saw a patient get better. That is the protein that currently is Cinryze. It's still made by what was the Dutch Red Cross. The Dutch Red Cross sold it out to another Dutch protein called Sanguine. A heat treatment was added in 1989. A company called Lev Pharmaceuticals bought the protein and shipped it into America. That pharmaceutical company was sold to Vero Pharma. That company was sold to Shire, and it's on the market as Cinryze. Okay, what do we know about Cinryze? Well, no, this is the German protein. Let's talk about Cinryze for a minute. I'm not going to show you all the data on the fact that these proteins work. They all work. Now, the proteins that are made from blood proteins, like Cinryze and the CSL-bearing protein, Berinert, they work. But they have to be given intravenously. And they have short half-lives, as I showed you on that sawtooth graph. That means if you're taking Cinryze for prophylaxis, you have to take an intravenous injection maybe twice a week. Forever. That is not so convenient. Now, it turns out that almost all the patients have learned to have a member of their family give them the drug, or they've learned to give themselves an intravenous injection. And it turns out it's not so hard to do, although you wouldn't believe it, but patients with hemophilia do it. And in fact, I have a lot of patients on Cinryze taking this intravenous injection twice a week. And they're free of disease, and they're very happy. And they don't want to stop. The problem, of course, is that doing this year after year after year, twice a week, is getting a little tiring. And the Berinert, which is the similar product, basically can be used to stop attacks. For some reason, the FDA approved one for prophylaxis and one for acute attacks. They're basically the same drug, but they both have to be given intravenously. And this is the Berinert data. And as you can see, this is time for onset of symptom relief with placebo and 20 units per kilo. And you can see there's a big difference. Now, in fact, the differences are bigger than the ones shown on these slides. But these are the kinds of data that were obtained during the double-blind study when patients had to find their way to an emergency room and get treated in a certain time frame. Now, Pharming is an interesting company. Pharming is a company in Holland again that basically got the idea of taking human genes, which we can do now. We can sequence a human gene and take it and put it in a test tube. And they introduced this gene into rabbits under the regulatory control, and this is all very complicated, of a bovine casein promoter. What that means is that if a rabbit gets pregnant and starts to generate milk, the human protein comes out in the milk. That's a pretty complicated scenario. And it also turns out that you can purify the human protein from the rabbit's milk. So you got to get the rabbit pregnant, you got to milk the rabbit, and you got to get the protein. Now, how you milk a rabbit, I have no idea. I see tiny little stools. But be that as it may, you can buy this protein. It's now been approved by the FDA, and it works. And again, it has to be given intravenously. Now, the question is, so you'd say, well, their argument is they have an unlimited supply. If you're making the protein from human plasma, you got to get the human plasma. And our FDA makes some interesting rules. One of the interesting rules that was made during the AIDS epidemic was that that American plasma is better than anybody else's plasma because we don't have HIV in America. Now, if you think back a long time ago, it was believed that HIV is something that's in Haiti, and it's not in America. Well, people started to use human plasma, and that law hasn't been changed. So the way it works is they collect human plasma, they send it to Holland or to Germany, they then purify the protein, and they send it back to America. So that's the way the system works, and farming says that they have an unlimited supply, but in fact their prices are the same and the advantage of the protein is not any different, and all of these proteins work. Now, knowing that bradykinin causes disease, there were people who had bradykinin inhibitors on the shelf, and so they pulled them out and they looked for treatment of these patients. And the blue line in this slide is an inhibitor of the bradykinin receptor. And in fact, that works too. And it works about the same way, and that's the Shire product called Calbitor. It's called the Cativant. And in fact, another protein that somebody worked out blocks kallikrein. That's the Calbitor product. And in fact, all these proteins work. They all work in the same time frame, and they all make the patients better. So Kalantide. And I can show you the effects of the drugs compared to placebo. This is Icatibant. Its brand name is Firazyr. And as I said, they all work. So now we have problems and advantages. The big problems are they all have some minor side effects. These are really minor side effects. Calbitor, the one that blocks the enzyme, causes anaphylaxis in a very tiny number of patients, like 2%. And so when it was approved, they said it has to be given by medical personnel. The Firazyr, the one that blocks the bradykinin receptor, basically doesn't cause anaphylaxis. And so people can carry it around in their purse, and if they start to have an attack, they give themselves a shot, and a half an hour later, an hour later, they're better. So all these drugs work. The only drugs that work for prophylaxis are the intravenous drugs because they last 3 or 4 days. These other drugs that affect the enzymes or affect the bradykinin receptor only work for minutes. They turn off the disease, and 2 or 3 hours later you're better, but they can't be used for prophylaxis. You can't take them every day. So that's the first thing. I would say that this is a long list of problems, but as somebody who basically takes care of these patients, this is an extremely minor list of problems. Basically, the plasma products have no risk of infection as far as I'm concerned. They have a theoretical risk. All plasma products have a theoretical risk, but they've been being made in Germany for 20 years, and nobody's gotten an infection. Hard to believe that it's a big problem. They're all given IV. That's a major disadvantage. People don't make allergy to the protein. They're making the normal protein from that normal gene as well. The recombinant product lasts a little less time in the circulation because rabbits put sugars on the protein slightly differently than human beings. Theoretically, the supply is limited. The small peptides that work very quickly on the bradykinin system I've talked about. So the real question is, what are the problems and advantages? The real problem is cost. These proteins are breathtakingly expensive. What do I mean by breathtakingly expensive? if you want to take the drug that's used in prophylaxis, which is this drug called Cinryze, you have to plan on spending $700,000 a year. That's a lot of money. Now, we saw perhaps 300 patients in Orlando a year and a half ago, and we asked the patients, how many can't afford the drug? And the answer was nobody. Every insurance pays for it at this point, because it's a life-threatening illness. So, in fact, there was no one in the room who raised their hand. And there were people on Medicaid. So, in fact, so far, it's okay. And the companies have all set up non-profit organizations to pay the copay. Because if you have a 20% copay on $500,000, that's $100,000. You don't have the money for that copay. So they'll pay the copay for you to make the money to pay that the drug costs. So this is a huge problem. And you think with five drugs that have already been approved, that in fact the costs would start coming down. Hasn't happened. All of the new drugs are as expensive as the old ones. Now, you'd also think that with a relatively minor disease, and I'd have to say it's minor, there may be 10,000 people in America who have this disease, that people would become interested in treating things that were perhaps more common. But that really hasn't happened either. So what's new? Well, subcutaneous infusions instead of intravenous infusions of the purified blood protein is under study. It's been under study for 2 or 3 years, and I don't understand why. But in fact, it's much more convenient. The blood levels are more stable, and it's a lot more convenient to give yourself a subcutaneous injection twice a week than an intravenous injection twice a week. And my guess is that that will happen. Now, the next thing is that people have made something called a monoclonal antibody. How many people in the room know what a monoclonal antibody is? Okay, so a few do. So it turns out that the way vaccination works is that you make antibody to a lot of different viruses in the vaccine. So, for example, if you're getting flu vaccine, you make antibody to components of the flu vaccine. Every one of those antibodies is a little bit different, seeing a little bit different part of the flu vaccine. And technology has become so sophisticated that people have learned to isolate the individual cells that make each one of those antibodies and grow them up and make a preparation in a bottle that contains a single antibody. And that's called a monoclonal antibody. And the thing about it is it only recognizes the one thing that one cell recognized. So if you get a flu vaccine, you have thousands of cells recognizing different parts of the flu vaccine, but every one of those cells only recognizes one little part. And people do this routinely now. It's absolutely amazing. So they made a monoclonal antibody to kallikrein, that enzyme that we talked about, and it turns out that enzyme, monoclonal antibody, turns off the enzyme, and it only requires a subcutaneous injection every 2 or 3 weeks. And that's being tested at the present time and is likely to become on the market. So the monoclonal antibody will make it, and it's likely, again, to be a competitor with all these other drugs that people have been working on. People have been working for a decade on an oral kallikrein inhibitor. I said that danazole, the first drug that I introduced, was an oral drug. It's much easier to take a pill in the morning. But in fact, it's turned out to be very hard to do that, to make an oral kallikrein inhibitor. They're testing one now. It's not clear that the drug potency is sufficiently high and to take the place of the intravenous injection. People are trying to make monoclonal antibodies to the clotting factors, because in that chart I showed you, the clotting factors have a role in turning on the attacks. Exactly what the role is not clear. And finally, there's a very sophisticated protein involved with putting things in your genes that turn off certain genes, and they are actually trying to turn off the gene for kallikrein in people who have a normal gene. Now, if you think about it from the medical point of view, we have 5 approved treatments. If you think about it from the patient point of view, they can live a perfectly normal life, although it costs a lot of money, and every once in a while they have to treat themselves. Some patients have attacks twice a year. Most patients have many more frequent attacks. why a drug company would make all of these increasing number of treatments when the market is so crowded, I have no idea. But in fact, that is the case. And so that's what we're going to talk about for hereditary angioedema. As I say, it's a nice thing to talk about. And the reason is I'll go to this meeting in September. There'll be 100 people with hereditary angioedema, and they'll be happy as clams. And the reason is that unlike most of the patients in the Immunodeficiency Foundation, where advances have been made and we can give intravenous immunoglobulin, we can do all kinds of things, we haven't cured the disease. We've got kids who we have to deal with one problem and then another problem and then a third problem. And some of the diseases, like the one that was emphasized here, chronic granulomatous disease, which I have some experience with, can be heartbreaking. So in fact, this is a disease that's cured. It's a pleasure to talk about it. And I'll open this up for any discussion that anybody wants.